This is the Breishis series, and today's the 22nd of January. Okay, we're on page 73. Now this is the section that deals with the names of Avraham and Sarai, Sarah. We pointed out yesterday, I'll just remind you, that if you compare verse 5 and verse 15, you'll see that what happens vis-a-vis his name and what happens vis-a-vis her name are really quite different from one another. Verse 5 says, "Your name shall no longer be called Avraham, your name shall be Avraham." Oh, thank you very much for bringing this one. It's quite clear that his name is being changed. Your name shall no longer be called, means it was called, it really was genuinely Avram. Now, from now on, it will be Avraham, page 73. But on the next page, page 75, in 15, God said to Abraham, "As for Sarai, your wife, do not call her name Sarai, for Sarah is her name." That doesn't say her name is being changed. It doesn't say she was Sarai, but from now on she will be Sarah. It says, don't call her Sarai. Don't do that. You know why? Because that's not her name. Her name isn't Sarai. Her name is Sarah. You've been calling her for decades Sarai? Too bad. That's not her name. So in her case, it's a revelation of her name. Whereas in his case, it's changing his name. Now that difference tallies well with the context. Let's look at the context generally and see what's going on other than just what's addressed to the names. Chapter starts, verse 1. When Avram was 99 years old, Hashem appeared to him. And by the way, there's no paragraph breaks here. No, the English makes it broken up as if it were separate sections. In Hebrew, it's all one long section. Hashem appeared to Avram and said to him, "I am Kel Shakai. Walk before me and be perfect." Okay, as we remarked in the past, Tamim doesn't mean perfect, it means whole or complete. Let's just say perfect to make it short. Now, what do you deduce from the fact that God says to him, "Walk before me and be perfect"? What can you deduce from that? That he isn't perfect. He's telling him, "I want you to achieve a new stage, a new level. I want you to rise to a new position. Walk before me and be perfect." So Abraham is being challenged here to achieve some new level in his relationship with God. Then it says, "I will set my covenant between you and you. I will increase your voice exceedingly." There's a new covenant that he's making with him. Abram threw himself upon his face. God spoke to him, saying, "As for me, this is my covenant with you. You shall be the father of a multitude of nations. And then your name shall no longer be called Avram, but your name shall be Avraham." Now, a person's name in the Tanakh, and lovely, you find this in other cultures and other literatures as well, a person's name indicates who he is, what he is, his identity, his essence. To change his name means that there's a fundamental change in who he is. He's no longer the same person that he was before. Well, indeed, God says, "I'm giving you a new covenant. And the covenant is that you will become the ancestor of a multitude of nations." which you aren't now, and the fact that you have a child named Yishmael is irrelevant. That's not where it's going to come from. This is going to require a brand new creation. Your name should no longer be called Avram, it should be called Avraham, for I have made the father of multiple nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful, make nations of you, kings shall descend from you. I'll ratify my covenant between me and you, between your offspring after you. So it's not just a covenant with you personally, but it's a covenant with you as the beginning of a covenant with a nation. Everlasting covenant to be a God for you, of your offspring after you. And I will give to you and your offspring after you the land of your sojourns. Another matter. You're going to inherit the land of Israel, the whole of the land of Canaan, as an everlasting possession. And I shall be a God to them. And it continues. God said to Abraham, it's for you. You shall keep my covenant, you and your offspring, after you throughout the generations. This is my covenant which you'll keep between me and you and your descendants after you. Every male among you shall be circumcised. The covenant of circumcision. This is a gigantic revolution in Abraham's life. And if you understand that a change of name indicates a fundamental change of identity, a change of essence, it fits very well. It fits very well into the context, since he has a new challenge to walk before God and become perfect. And he's going to become the father of a multitude of nations. And he's going to inherit the land of Israel, he and his descendants. And he has a covenant of circumcision. This is really a revolution in his life. And as a symptom of this revolution, also his name is changed. As far as Sarah's concerned, in 15, as for Sarai, your wife, did not came to her name Sarai, for Sarah's her name. What's happening to her? I will bless her. I'll give you a son through her. I will bless her. She'll give rise to nations. Kings and people will rise from her. Which is definitely a change in her life. But there's no new covenant. There's no new charge to achieve a new spiritual level. And indeed, the child that she's going to bear will be whose child? What does it say in 16? Yeah, but whose child?
Sarah? Isn't it obvious?
What does it say in 16?
I'll give you a son through her.
All right, I'll give you a son. Okay, how am I going to give it to you? Through her. But the son is yours. Not that it isn't hers, but she comes into the picture as bearing his son. Right? Which, by the way, was what motivated her to give Hagar to Avram. Right? She sort of saw that she had not borne many children. So she said, right? She understood that Avram's continuation has to come into the world. And if she gives Hagar to Avram, then maybe she'll be built up and she'll be able to do it afterwards. So this is not really a revolution in Sarah's life. And therefore, her name isn't being changed, it's just being revealed. It's a tremendous revolution in Abraham's life, and therefore his name is being changed. Fits the context very well. You with me? Now I want to share with you something considerably deeper. This is a Kli Yakar, who was a Talmud of the Maharal, who points out the following. If you look at the spelling of the names, Avram becomes Avraham. A hey is added to his name. Sarai is no longer going to be called Sarai, Sin Resh Yud. She's going to be called Sarah, for that is her name, Sin Resh Hey. Now you know that the letters have numerical values. A hey is worth 5, and a yud is worth 10. So a yud is really 2 heys. Now, what's happening to her? From Sarai, we're getting Sarah. So what's happening to her name in terms of letters?
She gives an H to Abraham.
Good for you. He's got the whole thing already. He gives a hey. Although the she gives isn't quite right. But at any rate, she loses a hey and he gains a hey. She goes from yud to hey. Yud is 2 heys. She goes from yud to hey. She's lost a hey. He gains a hey. Putting the two together, I'm just going to say it a little less specific than you. A hey is being transferred from her to him. that, but I have no right to infer who's doing the transfer, right? Whether she's giving it or it's being done by God, but hey, is being transferred from her to him, right? Now, what is a hay? What does a hay mean? What does it represent? Take a look on page 11. Verse 4. These are the products of the heaven and earth when they were created. Now, in the Hebrew, it's six lines down. Eile, soldos, shemayim v'aretz. These are the products of the heaven and earth. Behi bar'am. When they were created. And you see in the Hebrew print on page 10 that the hey is printed smaller than the other letters. That's not a mistake. In the Torah scroll, scattered in various places, you have some letters that are smaller than usual, and some letters that are larger than usual. That's the way they were given to Moses at Sinai. And when you have a letter that is of unusual size, that means that it plays a special role, that has a special significance. One explanation of the role of the hey here is to just change the vowels. Just, you know, the Torah scroll has no vowels. Just change the vowels and read it, Behei Bro'am, which would mean God created them with a hay. The hay is the instrument of creation. And that is a classical rabbinic comment. God created them with a hay. So, back on page 73, if what happens to Avram is that his name gains a hay, and to Sarai, we realize that her name was Sarah, so a hay is removed from what we thought her name was, Sarai, and given to Avram. What's happening is that this hay, which represents the power of creation, this extra hay, is being transferred from her to him. Now they each have a hay. The immediate consequence is that she becomes pregnant with Isaac. And the inference is, says the Kli Yakar, that while he had no hay, he couldn't father Isaac. Problem wasn't with her. She was sorrow with the hay, and she had an extra hay. She had no problem. She had double hay. He didn't have. The hay had to be transferred from her to him to put him in a position to cooperate with her in fathering Isaac. You with me? It's another indication that this isn't a revelation in her life, but it's a revelation in his life. He's going from zero to one, from nothing to having a hay. She has her own hay, he's carrying around an extra one. Losing one is not a revolution in her condition. Now, that's what the Kli Yakar says. As against Kli Yakar, you might object. At this point in their lives, when he's 99 and she's 89, what is the reproductive status of each of them, of Avram for his side and Sarah for her side? At this point, we read about it a couple of days ago. And at this point, Avram has already had a child named Ishmael. And she has no child. Isn't it a little peculiar to be told that he who has a child has no hay, and she who is barren has double hay, if hay is the power of creation? Isn't it backwards? Do you understand the question?
But his child, Ishmael, what is it worth?
Oh, that's the answer. Sure, he's not biologically infertile. He could have a child, Ishmael, who's going to be thrown out in the end. It's not going to be part of the Jewish people. But the power to create the second patriarch, the one who's going to carry this spiritual vision forward, that he doesn't have, and she has double. And because he doesn't have it, she can't have it together with him. He's not worthy of creating it. And now he becomes worthy of creating it, and therefore she becomes pregnant with Isaac. Okay, that's what the Kli Yakar says. And it, as I say, it confirms the picture that, and I don't have a revolution in his, in her life here. You have a revolution in his life, and that's why his name is being changed, and her name is just being revealed. Yeah.
Does this also mean to say that she's much holier than him?
There are many sources indicating that she has superior spiritual qualities over Abraham. We will see some of them. She was superior in prophecy. That's almost explicit, and it's recorded by Rashi and the rabbis. There are many such indications. I think someone ought to write a book on Sarah, just collecting together all the material from the Midrashim, from the Talmud, from the Zohar. It would make a fascinating study. I'll just give you a little hint. And there's a lot of material, but since you asked it, the Gemara says that Jacob is the highest of the patriarchs. Bechir Sheva Avos, the choicest, most superior of the patriarchs. Why? In what does Jacob's superiority show that all of his children remain Jewish? Whereas Abraham and Isaac had non-Jewish children, how many did Abraham have?
Seven.
At least seven. He had Ishmael first, and after Sarah died, he took another wife, and he had six more, which we'll read about, set them off to the east. Isaac had the twins, Jacob and Esau. Esau was also lost. Now, a person's children carry him in the next generation. If some have to be excluded, it means he too had elements that couldn't be incorporated into the Jewish people. Jacob, all of his children remained within the Jewish people, means he achieved a kind of purity and perfection that all of him could be represented within the Jewish people. I like to put it this way. Abraham and Isaac are precursors of the Jewish people. Jacob and his family are the Jewish people in microcosm. You already have the Jewish people as an entity. That's why the name of the Jewish people is taken from Jacob. We are Yisrael, which is Jacob's other name. We're not Abraham, we're not Isaac, we're Yisrael. Now, if that's true, that Jacob has this tremendous distinction, that all of his children remain Jewish, what should we say about Sarah? Sarah had one, and he remained Jewish. The only difference is that Jacob is third generation. He comes after the initial purification of Abraham and Isaac. She's first generation, without any purification to precede her. I think that's astonishing. We talk about comparisons. That's an astonishing observation.
Which one is higher, first generation or third generation?
The third generation is the recipient of all the progress of the first two generations. So if the third generation is on a higher level, it's not because of his work. It's because of the combined work of three.
But there's also more chances of him being lost.
No, it isn't true, because he's riding on the successes of Abraham and Isaac. Maybe there were chances, but by the time Jacob comes on the scene, he's the beneficiary of all of what's been accomplished by Abraham and Isaac. Right? So he is in the most pure position. You know, it's like when you sift flour, sometimes sift flour over and over and over again. The last sifting produces the most perfect flour. Doesn't mean that the last sifting removed the most chaff. If it's 11 siftings, the fact that the flour is most pure after the 11th sifting doesn't mean that the 11th sifting removed the most chaff. Usually the 11th sifting removed the least chaff. All right. So looking at the position doesn't give you an idea of the credit. Right? Jacob comes after two prior generations of tremendous accomplishment. She's the starting point. And she has this position where none of her has to be discarded. None of her has to be removed. That's an astonishing position for her to be in. Anyway, your question was a good question, and I'm just telling you there's a lot of material in that respect. Anyway, this is the difference between Avram and Sarah here. Now, I want to take you through a slightly technical matter here. It says, back in 5, again, for the 16th time, your name shall no longer be called Avram, your name shall be Avraham. From here, the Talmud says, anyone who calls the first patriarch Avram violates a positive, commandment, a positive norm of the Torah. The Torah says his name isn't Avram anymore. Your name shall be Avraham. Someone who calls the first patriarch Avram is violating what this verse says. This verse says it's not so. His name isn't Avram anymore. It's Avraham. Okay? Now, I want to compare and contrast that with what happens to Jacob. Look on page 189. Verse 10, the top of the page. Your name is Jacob. Your name shall not always be called Jacob. Israel shall be your name. Thus he called his name Israel. And now this is very complicated. This little 1.5 lines here is very complicated. But let's look at the middle section. It says, your name shall not always be called Jacob. Israel shall be your name. So after this, he calls his name Israel. What is he? Is he Jacob? Is he Israel? The answer is that, in fact, he's both. How do I know he's both? Because in verse 14 on the same page, it says Jacob. Many times in the future, he's called Jacob. And the next page, 21, he's called Israel. And 22, he's called Jacob. And it goes back and forth. And there are even occasions when God calls him Jacob. So clearly, according to the subsequent text, what's happening here is the name is being added. That means you have three different events that are entirely different from one another. Abraham's name is changed. Sarah's name is revealed. Jacob's name is added. The question is, how can you see in the words with respect to Jacob that it isn't the same as Abraham, which is being changed? Your name shall not only be called Jacob, your name shall be Israel. Why doesn't that mean that his name is Israel from now on? And if it doesn't mean it here, how come it means it with respect to Abraham? With Abraham, the Talmud is so careful, it says because of that you can't call him Avram anymore. You must call him Avraham. Why don't we have the result on the basis of the words here in verse 10, that he has to be called Israel only? We know it isn't true, but why don't the words indicate that? What's the difference between the words over here in 189 and the words on page 73? Yes?
It says, your name shall not always.
Okay, in the English, it's easy. In the English, it's easy. In English says, your name shall not always be called Jacob, implying that sometimes it will. Right? So that will make a clear difference between this and page 73. Page 73, it says, you shall no longer be called Avram, no longer, period.
It's the same oath.
Not quite. Good for you. You're looking in the right place, but it isn't quite. I'll tell you what the Malbim says. It isn't quite. Look very carefully and see it's not the same oath. But what I tell you in the English here is not an accurate translation of the Hebrew. The Hebrew here is very subtle. Let's look. Put one hand to 189. I go back to 73, and I'll show you something fascinating. I worried about this for years and years and years, and then Rabbi Perlman and I decided to look at the Malbim, and although I didn't end up understanding all of the Malbim, I got enough to answer my question. Verse 5, in the Hebrew, it's from the bottom, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 lines up. Right, page 72. 7 lines from the bottom. In the middle of the line, there's the 2 dots. All right? Now watch what happens. Velo yikare. It shall not be called Od anymore. Eshimcha, your name, Avram. Yikare is a verb. Shall be called. Lo makes it negative. Shall not be called. Od is an adverb. It's an adverb that tells you when the verb applies. So, shall not be called anymore. The od is anymore. Forever. Your name, Avram. That's fine. Od goes together with a verb. It's an adverb. That's where it belongs. Okay, now take a look on page 188. The second line, the last four words on the line, lo yikare, just like on page 72, shall not be called, shimcha, your name, od, Yaakov. The od here is not connected to the verb. It's split from the verb by the word your name. There's a rule in English composition. You don't split the adverb from the verb. Right? Here, the od doesn't go together with the yikare. It comes after shimcha. That's the wrong place for it. In grammar, it's the wrong place for it. Says the Malbim, the word od here doesn't go with the yikare. It's not modifying the verb. The word od goes together with shimcha, and it tells you what kind of shame we're talking about. What kind of shame we're talking about. There is shame, which is your ordinary name, what people call you, how you sign your documents. It's a name. Then there's a shimcha od. That's your essential name, your everlasting name. And there are two different names. Now, this is how it reads. God says to him, Shemcha Yaakov, your name is Yaakov. That's your regular name, your ordinary name. I'm not denying that, God says to him. I'm confirming that. I'm not changing that. Yes, your name is Yaakov. Didn't say that to Avram. Nothing like it. Your name is Yaakov. But, lo yikare Shemcha Od, Yaakov. Your Shemcha Od, your eternal name, will not be called Yaakov. I want you to know, you have a Shimcha, and you have a Shimcha Od. You have two appellations, two designations. One is your name, and the other is your eternal name. Now, if I stop here, what have I got? Your ordinary name is Yaakov. I have that. And I have an announcement that your eternal name is not Yaakov. And it's in the future. It shall not be called. Your eternal name shall not be called Yaakov. So what is he right now? Right now, he's still Yaakov. With an announcement that in the future, someday, he'll have another name, which will be his eternal name. Right now, he's got a transitory name, and he's got it, staying with him. But there's going to be, sometime in the future, an eternal name. Now it goes on. Ki im Yisrael yishmecha. In the future, your name will be Yisrael. Which name is that? Not the name that he has now. He's already got that name. The name that I announced to you in the previous clause, your eternal name, which will be in the future, that's Yisrael. At this point, if I stop here, what is he today? He's Yaakov and only Yaakov. All I know is that Yaakov is a transitory name and that he will have in the future a name Yisrael, and that name Yisrael will be his essential eternal name. And then it finishes, he called his name Yisrael, now he gives him the name Israel. He gives it to him now also, but now it's in addition to Yaakov. It's not alone. It's not his only name. His name is now doubled. That's why this passage is not comparable to the passage with Avram at all. With Avram, it says, Lo yikare, od shimcha Avram, your name shall no longer be called Avram. That's it. That cancels Avram out altogether. Nothing like that is said over here. Here he's told at the initial point, your name, your simple name, your transitory name, is Jacob. It is so. I'm not changing that. But I'm adding to it an eternal name. That eternal name will be Israel. And even now, when you are still Yaakov, you still have the transitory name, even now the eternal name can be applied to you as well, which I might not have thought. I might have thought, if you're talking about the eternal name, let's wait till he gets to that position where he earns it or where he's on that higher level. No, you can get it even now. And therefore, you're now entering a period of ambiguity, where Both names will apply to you, and that will cause you to have a kind of two-dimensional existence. But ultimately, you'll be Israel and only Israel.
Why did it? It's kind of like a Kim Israel and then it says Vayikra et Shemo Israel.
Because the verb in the first clause that you just recited is future. Future. Someday Israel will be your only name. That will be who you are. Today you're Yaakov. But even today I can call you Israel in addition, whereas in the future you'll be only Israel. Yeah.
With Abraham Od, even in modern Hebrew we say, don't do that Od, it's like immediate.
Yeah, but it says, Al Telech Me'achshav. So Me'achshav, Mityaches Le Al Telech, V'samuch Le Al Telech. אם אתה תגיד, אל תלך הביתה מעכשיו, אז זה, אתה הפרדת את מעכשיו, מהפועל, זה לא סגנון יפה. אתה צריך להגיד, אל תלך מעכשיו, הביתה. Okay, so that's three. And there are other changes, there are other applications to names. I just want to sensitize you to the fact that when names are discussed, you have to be very careful to discern what exactly is being said about the name. We've had three examples, and there are other types of examples as well. Okay, back on 75. Okay, I just want to point something out, which we will talk about in, well, how should I do this? We'll talk about it later, but I want to just point it out. So now, after all of this speech to Avram, 17, Avram threw himself upon his face and laughed and thought, shall a child be born to a 100-year-old man, and shall Sarah, a 90-year-old woman, give birth? What would you guess the meaning of those questions is? Is it unbridled joy? Is it doubt? Is it incredulity?
Doubt. Where is it?
Page 75, verse 17. Why is he laughing? If he's in doubt, why is he laughing? Laughter is a response of happiness. Right?
Going, crazy.
Yeah, okay. I mean, and maybe maybe the leprechauns are manipulating him like a puppet. I mean, maybes are endless. Maybes are endless. The point is, what could you get from the text? Let me just pause the comment here. There is an attitude towards text. I'm allowed to say anything which the text doesn't explicitly contradict. Then the sky's the limit. You know? Maybe he went temporarily insane. Or maybe he was doing it just to fool everybody around him. Or maybe he was winning a bet. Maybe he made a bet with somebody else that he could laugh today, and this gave him the opportunity to win the bet. I mean, who says no? Does the text say he didn't make a bet? So I could say he made a bet. Right? Then the sky's the limit. That is not an appropriate attitude towards any text. Certainly not this text. Why? Why is it not an appropriate attitude towards any text? What I'm now doing is attacking deconstructionism and postmodernism and a lot of the other modern frivolous anti-intellectual attitudes. Because the text is meant to communicate. Somebody wrote it for somebody else to read it and get a message. And you cannot communicate a message if the message depends upon facts that cannot possibly be known without resources other than the text. Unless you can assume that everybody knows those resources. So whatever text what the text means to convey has to be somehow in the text. So is he temporarily insane? Well, let's see. Does he jump off a cliff? Does he, you know, burn down his house? Does he do anything else? No, then it's not there. Did he make a bet? Well, does he collect the bet afterwards? Does somebody collect it from him? Does he make a vow not to make bets later? Where in the text is there any indication of what you're trying to say? An interpretation has to be supported positively from the text, not just be consistent with the text. So one has to look into the text and try to figure out. Now, it's true, if you look only at the questions, questions are ambiguous. Questions can be asked in a variety of circumstances. So from the fact that he asks questions alone, you don't know whether he believes it, disbelieves it, or doubts it. All three are possible. When you see that he laughed, somebody tells you something and you're filled with skepticism, you don't laugh unless you're laughing in his face. And as if to say to him, I don't believe you. But he's already prostrated himself before God, so it doesn't sound like he's sort of telling God off. And by the way, when God does tell him something that he doubts, what's his response? He tells him. Says to him straight out. He promised him the land of Israel. He said, how do I know I'm going to inherit it? And when he told him that he's going to have children, he believed it right away. We saw that before. He was already told he was going to have children, and he believed it right away. So, certainly no indication here whatsoever of disbelief, and there's not even much of an indication of skepticism or even doubt. Now, when he says, let me just point out the next sentence, when he says to God, oh, that Ishmael might live before you, that too could be taken two ways. If you thought he was in doubt, so then he could be saying, I have Ishmael, Ishmael exists, let him be a success. Or it could be, if you're promising me a child from Sarah, what's going to happen to Ishmael? What's going to happen to him? I love him. I want him to have a good future. If he's if my successor is going to come from Sarah, he's going to be eclipsed. He's going to be overshadowed. So he's praying on Ishmael's behalf because he does accept the fact that he's going to have a child. Now, God says to him, and here, let me just check the Rashi here. Yeah. Aval, in Hebrew, usually means but. There are, however, occasions on which Aval doesn't mean but. Aval means in truth. When we say, for those who know, who daven, when you say in Tachlin, Aval, Anachtu, Vavoseinu, Chatanu, we don't mean but we and our fathers have sinned. There's no but. There's nothing in the antecedent that you're objecting to. Aval means in truth. It's like saying emes. So God says to him, in truth, you saw a wife, your wife Sarah will bear you a son. You'll call him name Yitzchak. My covenant will come through him. But Yishmael also, I heard you. I've heard you. You wanted me to live before me. I'll have a special relationship with him also, and he'll have a special future. Quite right. He's not going to be lost, but he will be indeed overshadowed. He'll have to take a distant second place to the role that Yitzchak is going to play, but because you've prayed for him, he will not be utterly lost. All right? There's no indication here that it's a matter of, certainly not a matter of disbelief, and not even necessarily doubt, because somebody tells you something that you doubt. Laughter is not the appropriate response. Laughter is either joy or cynical skepticism, and certainly not cynical skepticism on Abraham's part. Yeah.
He's receiving prophecy here, right?
Right.
Don't you have to be in a joyous state to receive prophecy?
Let's say yes. You have to be at least in... That's an interesting point. You have to be in a joyous state to receive prophecy. I guess that's right.
Then I would assume his laughter is not coming from anything other than joy.
I'm trying to think. That's a very interesting comment. I'm trying to think whether you don't have prophecies of things that are very disturbing to the person who receives it, things that it's hard for him to take. Now, your point will be that prophecy continues here. You could have a prophecy which causes devastation and then ends. God tells Abraham to take his son as a sacrifice, as we will see, but he tells him that it's over. That's it. So you could say, then he's devastated, the prophecy ends. But here the prophecy goes on. That's a nice observation. I didn't think of that. It should be a relevant factor. Very good. Very good. Yeah.
On his comment, maybe you have to be joyous to begin the prophecy, and then once you're in the prophecy, whatever goes on until it ends.
Okay, so now I was just thinking of that. It precisely went through my mind. I was trying to think of prophecies where in the middle you get some devastating piece of news, and you may be very disturbed about it, but then the prophecy continues. The cases of devastating news that I can think of that ends there. What we need as a counterexample to his remark is a prophecy where in the middle you have a devastating piece of news, and the prophet is hurt and upset by it, but the prophecy goes on.
Does Moshe count?
Does Moshe count?
Because when God told him, I'm going to destroy Bnei Israel and start from you.
But there he invited him to respond. He invited him to respond. Yeah, God invited him to respond. We'll see that when we talk about the Akedah. And that's why Moses responded, only because God invited him to respond. God invited him into a dialogue. I'm glad it came out, because you see, this is how it has to be handled. You have to look for parallels, and you have to categorize and dissect the parallels in such a way to see whether you really have comparable examples or counterexamples. That's a very nice observation. Yeah.
Two quick questions. The first is, how old was Avram when he had Ishmael? Or the other son?
86, says explicitly.
So why is he like saying, shall a child be born to a 100-year-old man? So amazed.
Well, I suppose there's a difference between 86 and 100.
So is that like the...
The truth is, he has gone past childbearing. And she has also gone past childbearing. That will be testified to in the next parsha. Says so explicitly.
But at 86, he wasn't.
Right.
Okay, the other question is, what does it mean... threw himself upon his face.
Prostration.
Okay.
The last act of prostration is that you're down flat on the ground, including your face to the ground. That's why it's said that way all over. It's not unique here. That's the standard.
Does it always note that when during prophecies the prophet laughs?
No. It's very rare. But the fact that he's not laughing doesn't mean that he isn't in a state of joy. His point was that if you're in a state of joy and you laugh, the laughter had better be an expression of the joy. If the laughter is an expression of derision, then it's not consistent with being in a state of joy. That was what his point was. Okay, so God confirms it again. And then he says, Ishmael will become fruitful, be a great nation, but my covenant will be through Isaac, whom Sarah will bear to you. This time next year. When he finished speaking from Avram to Avram, God descended from upon Avram. In that innocuous little verse, there's a gigantic Jewish idea. In this prophecy, maybe even generally in prophecy to some extent, how is God related to the person? The picture that for the patriarchs is given is that they are the chariot in which God rides. Ascended means he's, so to speak, sitting on him. So they say, well, it doesn't really say that. It says he ascended from, now may al can mean over, from above him. Then the picture is he's sitting above Avraham, and they went up from there. But these sources indicate that the word al is just a way of hiding the reality, softening the blow, so to speak. The truth is that he ascended from Avraham, not from above Avraham. Your English translator here, I don't know what he had in mind, but he says from upon Avraham. Al can mean on, and it can mean above. It can mean either one. The text is ambiguous in that way. And here is one of the hints that Ha'ovos, Hein, Hein, and Merkava, that the patriarchs were the chariot for God's presence. Now, if you think of what a chariot does, chariot carries the driver, and the chariot goes when and where and in the pace that the charioteer drives it. It's a vision of faithfulness and completeness and power in service of God. They made themselves into the vehicle that God used to express himself in the world. This is this little innocuous verse is a gigantic philosophy. Rashi actually says it. Me'al Avraham, Lashin Kiyah he, who klapei Shechina. Rashi says the whole thing, basis rabba. V'lamadmu she'atzadikim rekavaso shel makom. Lashon Nekiyah means that it is a polite form which doesn't literally describe the reality. From above, but isn't really from above, because he's really riding on them. He's connected to them. He's not really above them. That's the idea of a chariot. Charioteer rides in the chariot. He's in contact with the chariot. And they merited that kind of contact with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. And this little verse indicates that, which if it didn't have that Midrash Rabbah, you'd never pay any attention to it. A lot of material, a lot of very fundamental ideas are hidden in seemingly innocuous phrases that don't have any particular significance, and that's where they're found.
Is it from within Avraham?
Within, no, from on. That's what it says, on.